to Fast Asleep with Gina Marie. Hello, everybody. I hope you had a wonderful week. I'm Gina, and Marie is here today. Honest. And, you know, we're all here for a classic short story. Thank you so much for checking in with us again. I am bringing you the conclusion to last week's story. It is so imaginative and so defiant and very dramatic. But what would you expect from a Pulitzer Prize winner? Now, before we get into that, first, Marie. Marie, what brings you here today?
Hi, everyone. It's Marie here with a challenge, a keyword challenge. Listeners, I hear you've been asking about my keywords. So, here we go. I'll give you 3 keywords, and all you have to do is identify which episode they come from. The winners get a shout out. You ready? They are radio, exposure, meaty. Now it's up to you. Match them with their episode. You've got this. And thanks, everyone.
That was great. Thank you. Finally, you guys. And we'll see you soon. Yeah. Ah, listeners, thank you. Hey, listeners, that's right, thank you for spreading the word. Yeah, our subscriptions, they're growing. I mean, you know, we're not leaping and bounding, but we're doing great, and I really appreciate it, thank you. And you know, some of these comments that I get, it is why we do this, because we're making people happy, and that's the goal, right? Alrighty, let's get to this. I'm sorry it's taking so long today. Our story, written by, ready? Willa Cather. Yes, I've heard all the pronunciations. I'm going to try to stick with Cather. I almost made it last week. And yes, of course, I am struggling over, why is she saying this name over again? It's last week's author and this week's author. Willa Cather. Oh, speaking of last week, if you haven't heard last week's episode, please stop, go back and listen to it. You're going to want to know all about Paul, the main character, and everything he's going through. Miss Cather's story about Paul comes from her very first collection of short stories, The Troll Garden. There are 7 stories in this collection, and each is about an artist of some sort. Each is about, well, you could say the accommodations that people who may seem different or may view life differently from the general population are often forced to make. Oh, and Paul is certainly one of those. As was Ms. Cather. I mean, they both dealt with, what's a good word for it? Alienation? From middle class. Yeah, the middle class society. From people who found it difficult to accept their differences and the conflicts, right, that came about because of them. You know what I'm getting at here, right? Well, as long ago as today's story was actually written, and it was long ago, it is still highly praised, this story, for its sophistication and its relevance. Doesn't get better than that. Also, I don't want to forget to mention Willa Cather's acclaimed novels about, she wrote about life on the Great Plains beautifully. Titles, O Pioneers, The Song of the Lark, and My Antonia. I'm not even mentioning her Pulitzer Prize winning novel. Of that last title, though, the very curmudgeonly journalist, scholar of American English, and very fearsome critic, I guess he was a big deal then, H.L. Mencken wrote, "No romantic novel ever written in America by man or woman, is one half so beautiful as Willa Cather's My Antonia. Nice job, Miss Cather. You brought down a very cranky, very cynical skeptic. I love that. And I think you're going to love this conclusion. If you don't love it, you certainly will never forget it. So, let's figure out what Paul can accomplish. And before I get into the story, I do want to give you a warning. The ending to this story is vividly dramatic. Please be advised of this. And with that said, duck in, everybody, for the conclusion, published in 1905, of Willa Cather's Paul's Case.
What you got going on? High nose, eyes closed, holding on. And I don't want another day to break.
Paul got what he wanted quickly. From music, any sort of music. From an orchestra to a barrel organ. He needed only the spark, the indescribable thrill that made his imagination master of his senses, and he could make plots and pictures enough of his own. It was equally true that he was not stage-struck, not at any rate in the usual acceptation of that expression. He had no desire to become an actor, any more than he had to become a musician. He felt no necessity to do any of these things. What he wanted was to see, to be in the atmosphere, float on the wave of it, to be carried out blue league after blue league away from everything. Oh, after a night behind the scenes, Paul found the schoolroom more than ever repulsive. Ah, the bare floors and naked walls, the prosy men who never wore frock coats or violets in their buttonholes, the women with their dull gowns, shrill voices, and pitiful seriousness about prepositions that govern the dative. He could not bear to have the other pupils think for a moment that he took these people seriously. He must convey to them that he considered it all trivial and was there only by way of a joke anyway. He had autograph pictures of all the members of the stock company, which he showed his classmates, telling them the most incredible stories of his familiarity with these people, of his acquaintance with the soloists who came to Carnegie Hall, his suppers with them, and the flowers he sent them. When these stories lost their effect and his audience grew listless, he would bid all the boys goodbye, announcing that he was going to travel for a while, going to Naples, to California, to Egypt. And then, next Monday, he would slip back, conscious and nervously smiling. Well, his sister was ill, and he would have to defer his voyage until spring. Matters went steadily worse with Paul at school. In the itch to let his instructors know how heartily he despised them and how thoroughly he was appreciated elsewhere, He mentioned once or twice that he had no time to fool with theorems, adding, with a twitch of the eyebrows and a touch of that nervous bravado which so perplexed them, that he was helping the people down at the stock company, and they were old friends of his. The upshot of the matter was that the principal went to Paul's father, and Paul was taken out of school and put to work. The manager at Carnegie Hall was told to get another usher in his stead. The doorkeeper at the theater was warned not to admit him to the house. And Charlie Edwards remorsefully promised the boy's father not to see him again. The members of the stock company were vastly amused when some of Paul's stories reached them, especially the women. Oh, they were hard-working women, most of them supporting indolent husbands or brothers, and they laughed rather bitterly at having stirred the boy to such fervid and florid inventions. Oh, they agreed with the faculty and with his father that Paul's was a bad case. The eastbound train was plowing through a January snowstorm. The dull dawn was beginning to show gray when the engine whistled a mile out of Newark. Paul started up from the seat where he had lain curled in uneasy slumber, rubbed the breath-misted window glass with his hand, and peered out. Oh, the snow was whirling in curling eddies above the white bottomlands, and the drifts lay already deep in the fields and along the fences, while here and there the long dead grass and dried weed stalks protruded black above it. Lights shone from the scattered houses, and a gang of laborers who stood beside the track waved their lanterns. Paul had slept very little, and he felt grimy and uncomfortable. He had made the all-night journey in a day coach because he was afraid if he took a Pullman, he might be seen by some Pittsburgh businessman who had noticed him in Denny and Carson's office. When the whistle woke him, he clutched quickly at his breast pocket, glancing about him with an uncertain smile. But the little clay-bespattered passengers were still sleeping. The slatternly women across the aisle were in open-mouthed oblivion, and even the crummy crying babies were, for the nonce, stilled. Paul tried to settle back, to struggle with his impatience as best he could. When he arrived at the Jersey City station, he hurried through his breakfast, manifestly ill at ease and keeping a sharp eye about him. After he reached the 23rd Street station, he consulted a cabman and had himself driven to a men's furnishing establishment, which was just opening for the day. He spent upward of 2 hours there, buying with endless reconsidering and great care. His new street suit he put on in the fitting room, the frock coat and dress clothes he had bundled into the cab with his new shirts. And then he drove to a hatter's and a shoe house. His next errand was at Tiffany's, where he selected silver-mounted brushes and a scarf pin. He would not wait to have his silver marked, he said. Lastly, he stopped at a trunk shop on Broadway and had his purchases packed into various traveling bags. It was a little after 1 o'clock when he drove up to the Waldorf, and after settling with the cabman, went into the office. He registered from Washington, said his mother and father had been abroad and that he had come down to await the arrival of their steamer. He told his story plausibly and had no trouble, since he offered to pay for them in advance in engaging his rooms. A sleeping room, sitting room, and a bath. Not once, but 100 times, Paul had planned this entry into New York. He had gone over every detail of it with Charlie Edwards. And in his scrapbook at home, there were pages of description about New York hotels, cut from the Sunday papers. When he was shown into his sitting room on the 8th floor, he saw at a glance that everything was as it should be. There was but one detail in his mental picture that the place did not realize, so he rang for the bellboy and sent him down for flowers. He moved about nervously until the boy returned, putting away his new linen and fingering it delightedly as he did so. When the flowers came, he put them hastily into water and then tumbled into a hot bath. Presently, he came out of his white bathroom, resplendent in his new silk underwear and playing with the tassels of his red robe. The snow was whirling so fiercely outside his windows that, he could scarcely see across the street. But within, the air was deliciously soft and fragrant. He put the violets and jonquils on the tabouret beside the couch and threw himself down with a long sigh, covering himself with a Roman blanket. He was thoroughly tired. He had been in such haste. He had stood up to such a strain, covered so much ground in the last 24 hours that he wanted to think how it had all come about. Lulled by the sound of the wind, the warm air, and the cool fragrance of those flowers, he sank into deep, drowsy retrospection. It had been wonderfully simple. When they had shut him out of the theater and concert hall, when they had taken away his bone, the whole thing was virtually determined. The rest was a mere matter of opportunity. The only thing that at all surprised him was his own courage, for he realized well enough that he had always been tormented by fear, a sort of apprehensive dread that, of late years, as the meshes of the lies he had told closed about him, had been pulling the muscles of his body tighter and tighter, until now, he could not remember a time when he had not been dreading something. Even when he was a little boy, it was always there, behind him or before or on either side. There had always been the shadow in the corner, that dark place into which he dared not look, but from which something seemed always to be watching him. And Paul had done things that were not pretty to watch. He knew. But now, he had a curious sense of relief, as though he had at last thrown down the gauntlet to the thing in the corner. Yet it was but a day since he had been sulking in the traces. But yesterday afternoon, that he had been sent to the bank with Denny and Carson's deposit, as usual. But this time, he was instructed to leave the book to be balanced. There was above $2,000 in checks and nearly $1,000 in the banknotes, which he had taken from the book and quietly transferred to his pocket. At the bank, he made out a new deposit slip. His nerves had been steady enough to permit of his returning to the office, where he had finished his work, and asked for a full day's holiday tomorrow, Saturday, giving a perfectly reasonable pretext. The bank book, he knew, would not be returned before Monday or Tuesday, and his father would be out of town for the next week. From the time he slipped the banknotes into his pocket until he boarded the night train for New York, he had not known a moment's hesitation. How astonishingly easy it had all been. Here he was, the thing done, and this time there would be no awakening, no figure at the top of the stairs. He watched the snowflakes whirling by his window until he fell asleep. When he awoke, it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Oh, he bounded up with a start. One of his precious days gone already. He spent nearly an hour in dressing, watching every stage of his toilet carefully in the mirror. Oh, everything was quite perfect. He was exactly the kind of boy he had always wanted to be. When he went downstairs, Paul took a carriage and drove up Fifth Avenue toward the park. The snow had somewhat abated. Carriages and tradesmen's wagons were hurrying soundlessly to and fro in the winter twilight. Boys in woolen mufflers were shoveling off the doorsteps. The avenue stages made fine spots of color against the white street. Here and there, on the corners, whole flower gardens blooming behind glass windows, against which the snowflakes stuck and melted. Violets, roses, carnations, lilies of the valley, somehow vastly more lovely and alluring that they blossomed thus, unnaturally, in the snow. Oh, the park itself was a wonderful stage winter piece. When he returned, the pause of the twilight had ceased, and the tune of the streets had changed. The snow was falling faster. Lights streamed from the hotels that reared their many stories fearlessly up into the storm, defying the raging Atlantic winds. A long black stream of carriages poured down the avenue, intersected here and there by other streams tending horizontally. There were scores of cabs about the entrance of his hotel, and his driver had to wait. Boys in livery were running in and out of the awning stretched across the sidewalk, up and down the red velvet carpet laid from the door to the street. Above, about, within it all was the rumble and roar, the hurry and toss of thousands of human beings, as hot for pleasure as himself. And on every side of him towered the glaring affirmation of the omnipotence of wealth. The boy set his teeth and drew his shoulders together in a spasm of realization. The plot of all dramas, the text of all romances, the nerve stuff of all sensations was whirling about him like the snowflakes. He burnt like a bundle of sticks in a tempest. When Paul came down to dinner, the music of the orchestra floated up the elevator shaft to greet him. As he stepped into the thronged corridor,
what you got going on? I know it's eyes closed, holding on. And I don't want another day to break. Take off, steal off, night away.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Warm shadow.
The music of the orchestra floated up the elevator shaft to greet him. As he stepped into the thronged corridor, he sank back into one of the chairs against the wall to get his breath. Oh, the lights, the chatter, the perfumes, the bewildering medley of color. He had for a moment the feeling of not being able to stand it, but only for a moment. These were his own people, he told himself. He went slowly about the corridors, through the writing rooms, smoking rooms, reception rooms, as though he were exploring the chambers of an enchanted palace, built and peopled for him alone. When he reached the dining room, he sat down at a table near a window. The flowers, the white linen, the many colored wine glasses, the gay toilettes of the women, the low popping of corks, the undulating repetitions of the Blue Danube from the orchestra all flooded Paul's dream with bewildering radiance. When the roseate tinge of his champagne was added, oh, that cold, precious, bubbling stuff that creamed and foamed in his glass, Paul wondered that there were honest men in the world at all. This was what all the world was fighting for, he reflected. This was what all the struggle was about. He doubted the reality of his past. Had he ever known a place called Cordelia Street? A place where fagged-looking businessmen boarded the early car, mere rivets in a machine. They seemed to Paul sickening men with combings of children's hair always hanging on their coats and the smell of cooking in their clothes. Cordelia Street? Oh, that belonged to another time and country. Had he not always been thus? Had he not sat here night after night, from as far back as he could remember, looking pensively over just such shimmering textures, and slowly twirling the stem of a glass, like this one, between his thumb and middle finger, he thought he rather had. He was not in the least abashed or lonely. He had no especial desire to meet or to know any of these people. All he demanded was the right to look on and conjecture, to watch the pageant. The mere stage properties were all he contended for. Nor was he lonely later in the evening in his loge at the opera. He was entirely rid of his nervous misgivings, of his forced aggressiveness, of the imperative desire to show himself different from his surroundings. He felt now that his surroundings explained him. Nobody questioned the purple. He had only to wear it passively. He had only to glance down at his dress coat to reassure himself that here it would be impossible for anyone to humiliate him. He found it hard to leave his beautiful sitting room to go to bed that night, and sat long, watching the raging storm from his turret window. When he went to sleep, it was with the lights turned on in his bedroom, partly because of his old timidity, and partly so that if he should wake in the night, there would be no wretched moment of doubt, no horrible suspicion of yellow wallpaper or of Washington and Calvin above his bed. On Sunday morning, the city was practically snowbound. Paul breakfasted late, and in the afternoon, he fell in with a wild San Francisco boy, a freshman at Yale, who said he had run down for a little flyer over Sunday. The young man offered to show Paul the night side of the town, and the two boys went off together after dinner, not returning to the hotel until 7 o'clock the next morning. Oh, they had started out in the confiding warmth of a champagne friendship. But their parting in the elevator was singularly cool. The freshman pulled himself together to make his train, and Paul went to bed. He awoke at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, very thirsty and dizzy, and rang for ice water, coffee, and the Pittsburgh papers. On the part of the hotel management, Paul excited no suspicion. There was this to be said for him, that he wore his spoils with dignity and in no way made himself conspicuous. His chief greediness lay in his ears and eyes, and his excesses were not offensive ones. His dearest pleasures were the gray winter twilights in his sitting room, his quiet enjoyment of his flowers, his clothes, his wide divan, his cigarette, and his sense of power. He could not remember a time when he had felt so at peace with himself. The mere release from the necessity of petty lying every day, and every day restored his self-respect. He had never lied for pleasure, even at school, but to make himself noticed and admired, to assert his difference from other Cordelia Street boys, and he felt a good deal more manly, more honest now that he had no need for boastful pretensions now that he could, as his actor friends used to say, dress the part. It was characteristic that remorse did not occur to him. Oh, his golden days went by without a shadow, and he made each as perfect as he could. On the eighth day after his arrival in New York, he found the whole affair exploited in the Pittsburgh papers. Exploited with a wealth of detail, which indicated that local news of a sensational nature was at a low ebb. The firm of Denny and Carson announced that the boy's father had refunded the full amount of his theft and that they had no intention of prosecuting. The Cumberland minister had been interviewed and expressed his hope of yet reclaiming the motherless lad. And Paul's Sabbath school teacher declared that she would spare no effort to that end. The rumor had reached Pittsburgh that the boy had been seen in a New York hotel, and his father had gone east to find him and bring him home. Paul had just come in to dress for dinner. He sank into a chair, weak in the knees, and clasped his head in his hands. Oh, it was to be worse than jail, even. The tepid waters of Cordelia Street were to close over him, finally and forever. The gray monotony stretched before him in hopeless, unrelieved years. Sabbath school, young people's meeting, the yellow-papered room, the damp dish towels. It all rushed back upon him with sickening vividness. He had the old feeling that the orchestra had suddenly stopped, the sinking sensation that the play was over. The sweat broke out on his face, and he sprang to his feet, looked about him with his white, conscious smile, and winked at himself in the mirror. With something of the childish belief in miracles with which he had so often gone to class, all his lessons unlearned, Paul dressed and dashed, whistling, down the corridor to the elevator. He had no sooner entered the dining room and caught the measure of the music than his remembrance was lightened by his old elastic power of claiming the moment, mounting with it, and finding all sufficient. The glare and glitter about him, the mere scenic accessories, had again, and for the last time, their old potency. He would show himself that he was game. He would finish the thing splendidly. He doubted more than ever the existence of Cordelia Street, and for the first time, he drank his wine recklessly. Was he not, after all, one of these fortunate beings? Was he not still himself and in his own place? He drummed a nervous accompaniment to the music and looked about him, telling himself over and over that it had paid. He reflected drowsily to the swell of the violin and the chill sweetness of his wine that he might have done it more wisely. He might have caught an outbound steamer and been well out of their clutches before now. But the other side of the world had seemed too far away and too uncertain then. He could not have waited for it. His need had been too sharp. If he had to choose over again, he would do the same thing tomorrow. He looked affectionately about the dining room, now gilded with a soft mist. Oh, it had paid indeed. Paul was awakened next morning by a painful throbbing in his head and feet. He had thrown himself across the bed without undressing and had slept with his shoes on. His limbs and hands were lead heavy, and his tongue and throat were parched. There came upon him one of those fateful attacks of clear-headedness that never occurred except when he was physically exhausted and his nerves hung loose. He lay still, closed his eyes, and let the tide of realities wash over him. Well, his father was in New York, stopping at some joint or other, he told himself. The memory of successive summers on the front stoop fell upon him like a weight of black water. He had not $100 left, and he knew now, more than ever, that money was everything, the wall that stood between all he loathed and all he wanted. The thing was winding itself up. He had thought of that on his first glorious day in New York, and had even provided a way to snap the thread. It lay on the dressing table now. He got it out last night when he came blindly up from dinner, but the shiny metal hurt his eyes. And he disliked the look of it anyway. He rose and moved about with a painful effort, succumbing now and again to attacks of nausea. It was the old depression, exaggerated. All the world had become Cordelia Street. Yet somehow, he was not afraid of anything, was absolutely calm. Perhaps because he had looked into that dark corner at last and knew. It was bad enough what he saw there, but somehow not so bad as his long fear of it had been. He saw everything clearly now. He had a feeling that he had made the best of it, that he had lived the sort of life he was meant to live. And for half an hour he sat, staring at the revolver. But he told himself that that was not the way. No. So he went downstairs and took a cab to the ferry. When Paul arrived at Newark, he got off the train and took another cab, directing the driver to follow the Pennsylvania tracks out of the town. The snow lay heavy on the roadways and had drifted deep in the open fields. Only here and there the dead grass or dried weed stalks projected, singularly black above it. Once well into the country, Paul had dismissed the carriage and walked, floundering along the tracks, his mind a medley of irrelevant things. He seemed to hold in his brain an actual picture of everything he had seen that morning. He remembered every feature of both his drivers, the toothless old woman from whom he had bought the red flowers in his coat, the agent from whom he had got his ticket, and all his fellow passengers on the ferry. His mind, unable to cope with vital matters near at hand, worked feverishly and deftly at sorting and grouping these images. They made for him part of the ugliness of the world, of the ache in his head, and the bitter burning on his tongue. He stooped and put a handful of snow into his mouth as he walked, but that too seemed hot. When he reached a little hillside where the tracks ran through a cut some 20 feet below him, he stopped and sat down. The carnations in his coat were drooping with the cold, he noticed, all their red glory over. It occurred to him that all the flowers he had seen in the show windows that first night must have gone the same way long before this. It was only one splendid breath they had, in spite of their brave mockery at the winter outside the glass. It was a losing game in the end, it seemed, this revolt against the homilies by which the world is run. Paul took one of the blossoms carefully from his coat and scooped a little hole in the snow, where he covered it up, and then he dozed a while from his weak condition, seeming insensible to the cold. The sound of an approaching train woke him, and he started to his feet, remembering only his resolution and afraid lest he should be too late. He stood watching the approaching locomotive, his teeth chattering, his lips drawn away from them in a frightened smile. Once or twice he glanced nervously sidewise, as though he were being watched. When the right moment came, he jumped. As he fell, the folly of his haste occurred to him with merciless clearness. The vastness of what he had left undone. Well, there flashed through his brain, clearer than ever before, the blue of Adriatic water, the yellow of Algerian sands. He felt something strike his chest. His body was being thrown swiftly through the air, on and on, immeasurably far and fast, while his limbs gently relaxed. And then, because the picture-making mechanism was crushed, the disturbing visions flashed into black, and Paul dropped back into the immense design of things.
What you got going on? High nose, eyes closed, holding on. And I don't want another
day. Listeners, please give me just a moment. If you, a family member or a friend, is experiencing any mental health crisis here in the United States, please call 988 right now. And for my international friends, please don't you hesitate to call your hotline right away. Thank you. Introduction information is from Nasrullah Mombrel, with her analysis of Willa Cather's Paul's Case for literariness.org. And there's other sources in our show notes. Music is Warm Shadow by Fink. Summoning by Adam Hurst. Music Box by Alexis French. Delicate Transitions by Gavin Luke. The Blue Danube Waltz by Johann Strauss and performed by the Tasmanian Symphony Orchestra. Clair de Lune by Claude Debussy and performed by Seanjin Cho. Darkness, Dark Wood 1 by David Darling. Contemplation by Suyi Park. And finally, Dark Cello by Maurizio Mignone. We will be taking a bit of a spring break after this, but don't you worry. We'll be back soon. And remember, you can reach me at fastasleepwithginamarie44@gmail.com, or you can always find me on Instagram, Facebook, and We Really Are Crazy on TikTok. And please, listeners, keep us here for you with your comments, your likes, and those wonderful subscriptions. Thank you so much for listening. Keyword, self-respect. Good night.
Won't you stop breaking in? Red sky, red light. Awakening. And I don't want another. Day to break. Take off.